Come to order, it's 3:04. With us today, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Gardner, Representative Book, and myself, Chair Olson. With four, we have a quorum. We anticipate the other three will be here shortly. First item on the agenda today is House Bill 357, Claims Against Real Estate Licensees. Mr. Feakin, care to join us at the table? And please state your name for the record and your affiliation, and welcome back.
Thank you, Representative Olson. I am Dave Feakin. I'm the Chair of the Alaska Association of Realtors Legislative Work Group, and I represent 1,600-plus licensed real estate realtors within the state of Alaska. House Bill 357 is a joint effort of the Alaska Association of Realtors, the Division of Occupational Licensing, and the Division of Insurance. The goal of this is to modernize the surety fund and to ensure consumer protection into the future. And in doing that, would implement a mandatory errors and omissions policy. I will allow most of my testimony will revolve around the surety fund and the reason for the change and then occupational licensing. And I believe you have Cindy Rice coming online to deal with the errors and omissions insurance. The surety fund was started in 1974 as a substitute for corporate insurance. It reimburses for losses of fraud, misrepresentation, deceit, and conversion of trust funds. The fund, by statute, has a balance of $250,000 to $500,000, and it's paid by licensees with a $30 fee that's paid every other year, every 2 years. And the reason for this change has came about for two reasons. A high number of frivolous-type claims that are filed against the fund is costing a considerable amount in administrative fees, and the drop in the number of real estate licensees. So you've got increased cost, and you've got a decrease in revenue actually coming into the fund. If you review the claims filed in the last 2 years, in 2006 there was 15 claims filed. Zero was paid. None of them were successful claims. They were all denied. In 2007, there was 13 claims filed, and there was fees paid on two of them. So what we're recommending with this bill is to change the surety fund to what's called a recovery fund and implement mandatory errors and omissions insurance for all licensees. To go to the recovery fund to recover funds from one of the acts of fraud, deceit, misrepresentation would require a change from the administrative hearing law process to the claimant would need a judgment from a court, an arbitration award judgment, or a settlement agreement. I think it's also important to understand that in almost all of these cases, these are what would be referred to as vexatious claimants. In other words, they are unrepresented by legal counsel. I've contacted the one of the attorney firms that works with errors and omissions insurance that would be working for the real estate industry, and they cannot remember a case that went to the surety fund where there was legal counsel of the parties involved. So if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
Well, I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Gatto, and actually we've seen this bill on several occasions, and I think probably start with Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I actually have talked with Mr. Feakin, and I appreciate that, and I also have talked with upwards of a dozen agents, brokers, and even an insurance company since we last had this bill up. And I have just a couple of concerns, and I'm open to suggestions for how to deal with them. One is, well, I guess this isn't really the place to talk about things that maybe somebody else is going to testify on, but you said that there's the person who, I don't remember who it was, but that nobody has used legal counsel to access the surety fund. But if we change that to a recovery fund and someone has to get a court judgment, we will see people having more of a need, I think, to have legal counsel if they have to go to court in order to get recover their loss.
Most of these claims are of the size that you could go to small claims court. In fact, I don't, maybe there's been one or so, but you could file the same sort of a claim without legal counsel within the small claims court or from a settlement agreement, which would come from the parties agreeing to settle, and then you would have that agreement to go to the recovery fund. So I don't see where it would change the requirement. There wouldn't be a requirement with per se.
A requirement to have
An attorney, no.
But if I'm a victim of fraud or deceit or some kind of, yeah, even if it's rare, my concern here is just to protect the consumer who has been victimized and make sure that when all's said and done, they're not out of pocket, that they can protect their interests and not be out of pocket.
Yeah, they could make the same. In fact, it's cheaper to go to small claims court than it is a surety fund. There's a $250 filing fee at the surety fund. I think it's $27.50 to file a small claims action.
Mr. Chair, I would posit that if I felt that that somebody had intentionally defrauded me, I might be inclined to hire an attorney to prove my case rather than do it myself if I don't feel like I know how to do it. That's my concern about this proposal.
Well, actually, we've got Mark Davis in the room, and we've also got Cindy Rice online. We can bring that up with both of them when we get to them, if you'd like.
Okay.
Does anybody else have any questions for Mr. Feaker? Representative Gatto?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Only because the small claims question arose, I think Article 1, Section 16 of the state constitution says that you are entitled to small claims if the amount is less than $250. And after that amount, you're entitled to a jury trial. And it is the practice of many people who have a small claim file against them simply to insist on a jury trial because the amount exceeds $250. So just about the statement, when you make a statement that you can always go to small claims, well, you can't always, because the Constitution limits you to a pretty tiny amount of money. I wish we could correct that. It would take a constitutional amendment. And so it's not something we're going to be able to do here.
But I think we're mincing the issue. Real estate agents are never, in my 20-plus years, and I think other people would, like Cindy Rice, would say the same thing, you don't charge a real estate agent with fraud. It is a combination of a number of things. And misrepresentation, deceit, and all these things are involved. But very little of it approaches the standard of the surety fund or the recovery fund, where the errors and omissions would be involved to cover the rest of it. The word fraud has to be associated with some act, which usually involves property condition, is what the majority of them deal with. So, these cases would almost always end up at errors and omissions. And then potentially the judge could say that a portion of this claim was fraudulent. But
didn't we bump the limit up to 10,000?
I think it's 15,000 now.
Well,
it's 10 or 15.
I think it's 10.
Is that small claims?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, it went from 7,500 to 10.
Yeah.
However,
is the limit on small claims.
If I may, Mr. Chair, even though we bumped it up to 10, you just can't walk in and sue somebody for $7,500 and get a small claims trial because of the Constitution that says you're entitled to a jury trial if somebody sues you over $250. So even though you have the protection of small claims court, it's up to the defendant to simply say, well, I prefer civil rules, and so we're on our way to the big court, go get yourself a lawyer. And if you have a small enough claim, like $1,000 or $1,500 or even $5,000, very reluctant to go to civil court over a $5,000 claim. So we may have raised it to 10, but it doesn't require that you go to small claims court.
But I think that'd be the case in any claim, not just the ones before us. I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Newman and Representative Gardner, you had a question?
Thank you, yes. I understand the desire and even the need to reduce the vexatious claims and, you know, that are baseless, and that moving to the recovery fund is an effort to do just that. Is there any other reason to switch from a surety fund to a recovery fund?
That's the prime. Well, you couldn't do it without adding the mandatory errors and omissions as a thought of the industry, because that would give, it would enhance the consumer protection actually by putting errors and omissions in place for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair. Is it true that when the $250 claim filing fee was instituted against the surety fund, that the number of claims dropped? And if that's true, could we not raise that to $500 or $1,000 and accomplish the same ends as moving to a recovery fund would do?
That I don't know. You would have to save that question for Mr. Davis.
Okay.
I'm unsure of the tracking doesn't really make sense that I see with
okay.
the so because you can't tell whether they're filed and closed in the same year.
Right.
So you really don't, it isn't, other than 06 and 07, there's a pretty good handle on that. But prior to that, it's hard to tell
okay.
as to what whether that went up or down with that change in the filing fee.
Okay, thank you.
I believe before we go any further, we probably ought to adopt this version as for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to adopt for committee discussion CS for House Bill 357, a Labor and Commerce version, /L for committee discussion.
I just noticed the date on it, and I missed the second meeting last week, so I apologize on that. And seeing no opposition, we'll adopt it for purposes of discussion. Are there any further questions for Mr. Feakin before we get Mark Davis up?
I do. Just
Representative Booth.
Now that we're talking about this CS, can you go over any of the changes that we talked about last week as compared to what we're looking at in the CS?
I'd rather, I believe they're all pretty much the same. And most of the changes were required, were at the request of occupational licensing and insurance. So we've reviewed them and don't have any problem with it. But I'd rather Mark comment on the changes and stuff, because it was dealing with the procurement of the actual policy, a lot of the stuff was.
That answers my question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Feakin, and I'd like the record to reflect we have a full committee now. We've been joined by Representative Ramirez, who just got out of a late judiciary meeting. Mark Davis.
For a couple hours, Mr.
Oh, have you?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Mark Davis, and I'm the Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The bill before you does propose changing the surety fund. There's been a recommendation by a legislative audit that the surety fund needed some revision. The industry proposed mandatory E&O insurance with conversion of the surety fund into recovery fund. 13 states currently have either mandatory E&O insurance or some combination of a recovery fund and insurance. The idea of insurance is quite a different dynamic than a surety fund. As the record that we have indicates, the surety fund is limited to relatively small claims and goes through an administrative law process. That is, you bring your claim, you try to resolve it if you can, and if you can't, you go to administrative law judge. That becomes a final judgment, and then one person can appeal to the Superior Court, which then acts as an appellate court. And then that eventually could go up higher if you wished. Insurance is a normal way to resolve commercial disputes once it's in place. Most counsel are, I would think it's a fair statement, trained to look for insurance. And therefore, if the claim is available and you have insurance, and this will be a proposal of $100,000, which is in excess of the typical surety fund claim. That is, if there was somehow the realtor had allegedly neglected to tell somebody about the house and it led to damages, then you would probably retain counsel, but counsel would know that they could get paid because A, there's insurance involved, and you can often resolve cases with insurance companies. At least that's often been my experience. When there's not insurance, then you really have the surety fund. The other thing that's happening within the industry is that about, according to what they tell me, about 75% of the licensees are covered in some form by E&O right now because they've chosen to have that coverage. Another 25% deem it too expensive to do so. So the question becomes, is this an economically feasible methodology? I asked my staff to look into that, and the low for an E&O, mandatory E&O, is in Rhode Island, which is $80 per licensee per year, and the high is $258 in Colorado, which leads to a mean of $158. Alaska, though, tends to be a little higher than the rest of the country, so we probably are more on the line of Colorado, perhaps. But even so, that would be a substantial reduction from the current fees, which are at least $1,000, and sometimes up to $2,000. So actually, in the sense that we have licensees already being covered, that is, insurance is already taking care of this problem, but it's a fairly expensive proposition because it's not a group policy. And with this bill, those, the changes that were made at the request to the Department of Insurance was to change it to a master group policy, which is what the Division of Insurance recommends. So we concurred with that language. And that's the major change here, is specifying a master group policy with certain provisions in it. It also allows the department to seek a reasonable fee per year, so that no one bids at a fee that we deem reasonable, that we wouldn't have to take it. And it has a saving clause. If there isn't a reasonable bid, then the bill goes away. We revert back where we were in case no insurance company wants to underwrite this particular policy.
So at this point in time, Division of Insurance and Commerce are both comfortable with the current.
Correct. The changes that were made were in conjunction with the Division of Insurance, and I'm not going to try to be an expert on that. Director Hall certainly is, but I've certainly spoken to her and Deputy Director Trout, and they concur with the CS.
I know Director Hall well enough to know that if she had a problem, she'd be sitting probably in the first row.
Indeed, she had a problem with the other one, and that's why we met.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite ready. Well, I would just ask you, can you speak a little bit about the difference, if you're in a, well, how E&O insurance works generally, and if my understanding is correct, that if it's not an error or omission, and then the coverage is denied if it's outright fraud or something bigger, intentional deceit, the coverage is denied, and then when you go to a surety or recovery claim?
Yeah, Representative Gardner, those are very good questions, and let me try to parse that out. There's a couple of questions there.
Yeah.
One is errors and omissions and policies are written by insurance companies, and all insurance companies are contracts of exclusion. That is, they cover some things and they don't cover other things. You've all had that experience, I'm sure. So this would cover in the course of your scope as a licensee for up to $100,000 for an occurrence that you were responsible for, and would defend you if you claimed you weren't responsible. That's the essence of errors and omissions. However, if it was intentional or fraud, traditionally errors and omissions insurance does not cover that. And what would happen is if the insurance company determines that it might not be covered, and they would seek counsel before doing that, and I should give you my disclaimer that I used to be involved in that kind of work, then they write what's called a reservation of rights letter. And I don't know if you've ever seen one. Dear policyholder, you know, we have your coverage and you've been sued, and we will defend you, but we don't think you have coverage. And then when you receive that letter, you have the right to seek your own counsel or continue with the insurance counsel until they determine whether you are indeed covered. And there's a series of steps that go forward. So it doesn't mean you're absolutely just, they just divorce you. And if they wrongfully divorce you, then they can be liable under bad faith defense, which I'm sure you've heard of that claim. So it becomes a little complicated, but basically insurance companies have a tendency to settle when they see meritorious claims, and also pleading, the way things are pled, covers this. That is, if I plead fraud, then I know perhaps that they won't be in coverage. If I plead misrepresentation, honest mistake, omission, I know there will be coverage. So plaintiff's counsel sometimes drives the ship.
Thank you.
And the next person testifying will be Cindy Rice, and she can give you specific examples of both coverage and potential claims, if that helps.
Okay, and a follow-up. If there is a claim and it's not covered under errors and omissions and it goes forward to one of the funds, can you describe the impact on the consumer of switching from a surety fund to a recovery fund?
I think once you're dealing with fraud, the surety fund covers that now, and the recovery fund would also cover that, Mr. Gardner, through the chair. So that, I think the outcome would be similar. I also think, though, if it was true fraud, you'd really want to try to sue beyond the fund if you could, and I think that will tend to occur. That is, you're going after the personal assets, if there are any, of the person who may have committed the fraud. And that's been what I've often seen in bad faith recovery cases.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
This bill, in which it talks in its sponsor statement about E&O insurance, also has a Section 8 in it, which seems to be a new requirement that a real estate broker maintain a place of business in the state. Why is that here?
Representative Drew, through the chair, that was a request by the industry. And I think the industry and the chairman of the Real Estate Commission believe it. You should have a place of business in the state. I'm not sure I would concur.
Paul?
Is there anybody from legal on to see whether that is even legal or whether that is an interference with interstate commerce?
Representative Luther, the chair, I've been told by the legislative drafters have looked at this and they believe it is appropriate, can be appropriate. So I think it's more of a policy issue than a constitutional issue. Because real estate is a domain issue, that is in the domain of the state, and also deals with property in the state, states have been able to make this requirement, is my understanding. The question, therefore, is one of policy. But do you want to do that? This is what's called the brick-and-mortar clause.
Pardon me?
Follow-up.
What do you mean by a brick-and-mortar clause?
You have to have a physical place of business in the state. This is maintain a place of business in the state. Traditionally, lawyers call that a brick-and-mortar clause. That is, you have
physical
to have
location.
Physical building. Location.
And is that basically to protect in-state realtors from out-of-state competition? I remember once upon a time, that was what the Bar Association had. And if you were going to practice law in any given state, you had to have a residence, maintain a residence and an office in that state. Mm-hmm. But subsequent to, that was maybe 15, 20 years ago, most of the states have loosened the requirement. And as long as you pass the bar exam, you can practice any place. So what's the purpose of this, really?
Representative Drew, through the chair, I think the purpose is to make sure that you understand Alaska law and the real estate in this state, because you're trying to sell a something that is not it's a non-tangible good. It is tangible. It's real estate, so you can't move it. It's not fungible. So the idea is you should know what you're selling should be in place. I think that's the argument. Versus if you're selling something that is a fungible good, which is in interstate commerce. Real estate, by its definition, is not in interstate commerce. But I do understand the United States Supreme Court struck down several of the bar associations because services are fungible between lawyers, at least who pass the bar, and the bar is a certification that you know the law in the state, even though you're not residing there.
Follow.
And aren't realtors given any tests that would indicate that they're competent to practice
realtors? I'm not, Chair, I don't think it's an extensive test as the bar is in. I think it's
And just one more follow-up question. You said you don't necessarily agree with this provision. Could you tell me why?
That is your right, ma'am. I do believe in competition to the extent that it makes sense, but also believe in protecting consumers. This is a tough call because I think that with non-fungible property that is not in interstate commerce, the state has a great interest in making sure you actually know the property you're selling, that you're not selling. The fraud in real estate has occurred when people are selling land, sometimes in the interstate, that is, you're selling property that you've never seen, that may be underwater. Or maybe inappropriate for usage, but because no one's ever been up there. So I think that in that sense, this could be pro-consumer. On the other hand, I think that traditionally requiring someone who is otherwise available for licensing to be physically in the state can chill interstate commerce.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that issue, Mr. Davis, you talked a little bit about real estate fraud and ensuring that people who sell real estate in the state have an idea of what they're selling. And then we're also talking, at the top of page 7, about real estate recovery fund. And before issuing a license to an applicant under this chapter, the commission will ensure that the applicant is complied with provisions and statute. And they talk about other issues that are very germane to this bill. Don't you feel that it would be a lot easier to ensure that all that happens if a company has a physical location in the state that you can reach out and actually touch them?
Representative Newman, through the chair, I would agree that it's always easier to conduct an exam in-state. As a former banking commissioner, I can tell you that we had out-of-state companies, and we expended a lot of money checking on those companies, particularly premium finance companies, which you probably never all of you may have heard of, but they make loans, very large loans, on insurance. So it's much easier to examine an in-state institution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to get Cindy Rice online right now. She's three time zones away from us. And
in the wrong way, I'm sure.
Cindy, are you still with us?
I'm here, yes. I'm here. I'm at the airport, so you'll have to forgive me if there's loud noises in the background. I'm getting ready to fly.
Have you followed most of this so far?
Yes, I have. I've been on the line the whole time.
Can I get you to state your full name and your affiliation for the record? Then I'm just going to open it up to questions to you.
Sure. My name is Cindy Rice Grissom, and I'm CEO of Rice Insurance Services Company. We provide the mandatory group programs in 11 of the 13 states that currently have mandatory E&O programs. And my family's been involved in handling mandated E&O programs since 89. So I was asked to be on the line to kind of answer questions as far as how the group E&O insurance programs work, and I'm just here to, answer any questions you all may have.
Representative Gardner.
I'm not sure how I want to ask this question, so I think I'll pass for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ledoux. Well, Cindy, it looks like you get off pretty light today. We appreciate you.
Sure. One thing I might point out, though, that y'all might want to be aware of, too, is that you don't really have to file a suit to recover under the insurance. The claim is typically defined as a demand for money or services. So if you have E&O insurance, it doesn't necessarily have to be a lawsuit in order to recover. And that's something that I'm not sure that was mentioned before.
So you're saying like a at-fault auto liability incident where one party is obviously responsible and didn't go to litigation, just get settled?
Right.
But it's clear-cut?
Right.
Representative Gardner has one now, finally.
Well, I'm just not sure how to put this, but I started out looking at this bill and thinking that it was kind of a cost shifting from brokers who were buying coverage for the agents under them, and maybe they were shifting it to the agents. But when I called and talked to a lot of different agents and they told me they're paying about $50 a month for coverage, then I thought, well, gosh, if they can get it from you for $200 or something in that neighborhood, the brokers are really making money by selling them the coverage at more. And it turns out that I think it's not that they're making money, but their costs associated with just even the bookkeeping for it. And basically, it looks like really it can be purchased more cheaply, and the brokers were doing it to make sure that everybody was covered. It's sort of what it looks like to me, and that it's not a problem from their perspective to have the agents getting their own. But what the insurance agents I talked with told me is that they calculate the coverage based on the sales for the previous year, and that it's not a flat rate but a percentage. So when you quote or give a kind of an estimate of what you can do it for, what you can offer E&O insurance for in this state, is that just kind of an average?
Well, what we were looking at is what is the group premium per licensee in the other states, and what they do, the actuaries would actually look at it and try to make a determination. When it's a brand new program, you don't really have a book to review to say, okay, this year we had X number of claims, we paid out so much, we need to collect this much per licensee in order to, you know, cover our expected costs. So when you go into a new state, it's typically kind of like riding the unknown. But in past years, I mean, the premiums have increased from where they were before, so no one's ever gone in and had a price, you know, higher than, you know, like $243, which it is now in Colorado, to start with for their first year. And so I would not anticipate that Alaska would be any more expensive to write than Colorado. Of course, the difference is that Colorado has a lot more licensees. You all are considered a small state, but now this past year, Wyoming passed legislation, and I would consider Wyoming to be more akin to, you know, having more resort properties, so that they would have higher property values based on what the research that we did, and their group premium is $150. So I can't imagine that it would be too, you know, I would probably think it would probably be more like Colorado, but I don't, you know, until it actually goes out, the actuaries won't give me a hard price. And that's why I think the putting the information in that if you can't get a price that is, you know, deemed reasonable, then you don't have to have the group program that year. But that's really never happened in the history of mandated programs.
Thank you.
So when you do have enough numbers, say in 2 or 3 years, it'll be rated on Alaska experience, or will it be rated on national experience, or on both of them combined?
It's kind of a combination. I mean, what you can't expect to have a profit in every state every year, but you kind of look at it as a whole group. And, you know, some of the smaller states are probably going to have years that are, you know, kind of, you know, more extreme than the larger states, which are going to be a little bit easier to analyze. But what they do typically is they'll look at the actual loss experience from the specific state, and we'll look at the the number of claims that were made and what the averages were, and come up with a premium. But they do kind of look at the other mandated state experience, and they usually throw out the real big ones and throw out the real low ones, and kind of look at the kind of a median expectation.
Are you going to be putting this out on admitted paper or surplus lines?
We always use admitted.
And are you retaining most of it, or are you going to be laying it all off, or?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to be reinsuring most of it, or are you going to be keeping?
Oh, well, we actually use Continental Casualty Company, and I don't believe that they would reinsure it, because it's $100,000, you know, limits, and they're used to writing a lot more than that. They may have some reinsurance on the excess policies that we write, but I'm sure they're keeping all the $100,000 claim limits.
Anybody else have any questions? Well, I think you can catch that flight now. We appreciate you.
if anybody thinks of anything afterwards, I'm available and glad to answer questions anytime. As long as we can figure out a convenient time so that you don't have to call me at 4 a.m.
I don't think that'll be a problem, believe me. Thanks again.
Thank you all very much.
We don't have anybody else online. Do we have anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I think we'll close it to public testimony and bring it back to the committee. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Speaker. I mean, Mr. Chair.
I like the other one. But yeah.
I'm still troubled by the recovery fund thing, and it seems to me that we could accomplish the aim by simply increasing the fee for filing a claim against the surety fund. Since the fee is not refundable unless you win, the nuisance claims, if it's enough to be painful, people might, you know, gamble that they might lose their $250 and go ahead and file. But if the fee is $1,000, they might not be willing to do that. And yet people who really feel they have a genuine case would not be dissuaded.
my thought would be that there are people that have a lot more experience in this than us that have put this thing together, and being a new program, it might be to the advantage of both the program and the consumers and even us to get it up and running and then maybe look at it in a year or two and see how it's doing before we tweak it, because it looks to me like everything is pretty well intermeshed the way it's structured right now, and that if we tweak it before it's up and running, before we even know if it has any problems, that we might have any number of unintended consequences and end up blowing it out of the water for something that we didn't foresee.
Mr. Chair, in speaking with all the agents I have, and I tried to go with big ones and small ones and kind of across the board, and it seemed to be that there was broad support for the E&O requirement. And but what people told me is that there were people who had concerns about the recovery fund, and I think a lot who kind of hadn't been attending very well, and anyhow, that's what I heard. It's not as broadly supported as the E&O mandatory change.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, I tend to agree with the chair, and when we look at pieces of legislation that come through like this, and we have companies or industries that want to try and make the system better for themselves, they still are playing within the rules, but actually they have to evolve. It's just like everything else has to evolve in this state, and there's new issues that they have to deal with. They've looked at what they've got and they've found better ways to deal with that, and I really take that very seriously. I certainly am not an expert in real estate. I like to talk to as many people as I can, but when I have people that in an industry like this that tends to look at the issues that they deal with, and certainly this is going to the $15,000 claim limit is being too low, and how they can go about making sure that the buyer, it's actually a way to me, when I read this bill, it's a way to help protect the person who's purchasing a piece of real estate, to make sure that there isn't unforeseen damages to a home. If there is, that there's a way to go about getting those repairs without a lot of lengthy and costly legal services involved. And I think that could only be a substantial benefit. When I find people like Mr. Davies or Ms. Hall support things like this, I take that very seriously, and I tend to follow their recommendations on this. It's my comments.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I think it's important to take the comments of industry seriously, but we've got to remember that as a committee, our obligation is to consider those comments, consider comments that we've heard from other folks, and independently analyze things. So I'm not willing for this committee to simply become a rubber stamp for something, anything that industry says.
Representative Ledoux has the floor. You done?
I am.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, you know, I'm certainly not suggesting, and I don't appreciate, you know, I hope there wasn't an implication that this committee rubber stamps anything. We certainly have taken a good hard look at this. We've had testimony from quite a few people, and I appreciate the testimony that we've received. I have analyzed this independently, but I certainly am not saying that this committee or any other committee rubber stamps anything.
And I believe this is the first meeting that we've had on this bill where everybody's been on the same page, at least as respects Division of Insurance, Commerce, the people putting the program together, the realtors and the company are pretty much on the same page. I remember the first meeting when we went off in about four different directions, and I believe that to their credit, the realtors have gone back and addressed most of the issues, maybe not all of them, but enough to where I'm comfortable and seeing if the thing can get off the ground. Ultimately, the people that are going to hear about it, if it isn't working, are going to be the people that are trying to put it together. They're, you know, if there's a flaw in it, they're going to hear about it a lot sooner than we do. And ultimately, if the consumers aren't going to happy, everybody's going to hear about it. But again, I think the only way we're going to find out if it works is give it a shot. Representative Ledoux.
One of the other things that I'm uncomfortable about the bill is the section that requires the office in the state. And I can understand that you don't want people selling real estate that they may not have seen. But on the other hand, we don't require if somebody is to sell a piece of property in Nome or Kotzebue, and they happen to be a realtor in Southeast, that they have an office in Nome or in Kotzebue. So that just troubles me.
I won't speak for the Division of Insurance or Commerce, but I would suspect it's a lot easier for them if they have a problem with a real estate broker to deal with them if they have a presence in the state rather than if they're in Florida or Texas or Puerto Rico or wherever. But I think you see that in other – I don't think the real estate profession is the only one that limits a presence to within the state, at least in office. So do you have an amendment, or are you –
I think I just kind of want to hash it out a little bit first. I mean, an office in the state, would that mean that somebody actually has to be in that office in the state, or is it just a requirement that they take out a lease, you know, a couple hundred square feet? And then if that's the requirement, then other than the owner of the 100 square feet, what good does that do?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Book.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, last year we had a bill, I believe, that talked about mortgages. And one of the requirements was that anybody that was going to make real estate mortgages had to be a resident of the state. They had to have brick and mortar in the state. And one of the reasons that I recall for that, that I'm relating to here, is that we were having out-of-state mortgage lenders who weren't necessarily knowledgeable, reputable, or and there was a certain amount of clarity, I think, that came about through that bill. And in that way, I'm going to support this piece of legislation because I think it is important that for the purposes of what we're trying to do here, that there is local representation in the form of a real business here, and I think that's the attempt. That's my view, for whatever it's worth.
Follow up? Representative Gardner, I can see a question for me.
The hair is burning over here. Yeah.
Okay, two questions. One is, we talked about if the E&O insurance is not available cost effectively in the state, it wouldn't be required. Is that actually in the bill, or is that a commitment by the Department of Insurance? So that's in the bill. I'd like to know where, because I'm kind of missing it.
Mr. Beacon, please join us again.
One question, and then the second question has to do with timelines. Initially, it said that in order to file a claim against the recovery fund, it would have to be done within 2 years of the origin of the claim, of the fraud itself, whatever it was. And then because we had a concern about that, that was changed, and it has to be filed within 2 years of the court date. And I just want to confirm my understanding that, or 2 years of the judgment, getting the judgment, my understanding that there is no time limit between the actual occurrence of the fraud and the person going to court. You might not. Okay. Those are my questions.
Yeah, on the first question, I was looking for the answer while you were asking this. Page 6, middle of the page, line 15. If the commission is unable to obtain a master errors and omissions policy to ensure licensees that meet the terms and conditions established under this section, the requirement that a real estate licensee carry and maintain their submissions insured is void. And then in another place, it outlines that the commission, the department, shall establish by regulation the terms and conditions. That's on page 5, line 25.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did see that, but it didn't. I mean, what if they're able to obtain errors and omissions policy, but it's going to be $1,000 a year? Because we talked about that it wouldn't be required if it weren't available at or around the amount that we're expecting.
That is on page 5, line 25. The department shall establish by regulation the terms and conditions of the errors and omissions policy. So the goal there was to put it in regulation rather than a statute, because it would be very difficult to change that amount 5 years from now.
Exactly. I understand. It's there. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Pekin?
Thank you.
Thanks again, Mr. Pekin.
Roll.
Well, any further questions? What is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move CS for House Bill number 357, Labor and Commerce, / L from committee with any attached fiscal notes or recommendations.
Anybody want a roll call, or is there any opposition?
I just want to object because... I just want to ask, Mr. Chair, does this go to another committee?
Finance.
Thank you. I'll remove my objection.
Seeing no opposition, we'll move it on to finance. We'll take a brief of these and sign the paperwork. And do you need to? Last bill is House Bill 319, Dental and Dental Assistance. Patty, are you going to carry this one? Your first bill.
Yes, my please. First bill.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And
Chair Olson and committee members, for the record, my name is Patty Krueger, and I am staff for Representative Ramros. I thank the committee for the opportunity to present House Bill 319. Oral health plays a key role in overall health. Unfortunately, not all Alaskans enjoy good dental health due to geographical barriers, cost of dental care, and limitations on dental personnel. House Bill 319 follows the provisions already in place in 36 states allowing for expanded duties for dental assistants, thereby improving access to dental care and reducing cost of dental care. With expanded duties, dental assistants can help community health centers and traveling dental teams provide greater access to care and more cost-effective care. This bill specifically lays the framework for expanding dental assistants' duties for two specific procedures. It would allow a certified dental assistant under a dentist's direct supervision to place fillings into cavities prepared by a licensed dentist, and allows a certified dental assistant under a dentist's direct supervision to polish teeth that have already been clean of tartar. Dental assistants who perform expanded duties of packing cavities or polishing teeth will have to pass a training program and an exam prior to becoming eligible for certification by the Alaska Dental Board. Furthermore, the supervising dentist must personally authorize the procedure and examine the patient afterwards. Dental assistants are not currently regulated by the state, and House Bill 319 will set forth standards required to become certified to perform these procedures in Alaska. This bill is supported by the Alaska Dental Society, the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners, the Alaska Dental Outreach Consortium, and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. House Bill 319 meets the preliminary report of the Governor's Health Care Strategies Planning Council. A blank CS is up for consideration today. This committee substitute incorporates the changes brought forth in a legal memo which accompanied the Hess version of House Bill 319. I thank the committee for hearing this bill and appreciate their support for this legislation. if the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can't get off that easy. He's smiling and ready to go. On page 1, in line 13, where it says the board may by regulation establish fees, renewal, and continuing education requirements. What do you feel the intent of that may be? What would the fees be? Would renewal, you know, as far as renewable fees or continuing education requirements, can you kind of explain what that would be, how much fees would it be? Is it just enough fees to cover the actual cost of administration? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. Chair Olson, I have Dr. David Logan from the Dental Association here, and if it is all right, I'd like him to come up and address some of the questions.
Let's adopt the
Mr. Chair, first, but before we do that, Mr. Chair, if we could adopt CS for House Bill 319 / V, Victor, for committee discussion.
Well, welcome. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and we'll take shots at you.
Hi, I'm David Logan. I'm a dentist here in Juneau, and I'm also the legislative chair for the Alaska Dental Society. Through the chair, Representative Newman, your question about establishing regulation of fees and renewal and continuing education requirements, the intent there was to allow a fee that would recover some but probably not all of the costs. A similar situation exists as an example for the hygienist for their certificate for local anesthesia, which is a relatively nominal fee, I believe $50 there, and it covers most of the administrative costs, but those that aren't are passed on through the general licensing fees.
Follow up?
Yeah, so did we didn't get a kind of an estimate on the cost, Dr. Logan, on that, of what the fees would be and what type of continuing education requirements would be we'd be looking at.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, kind of looking at board discretion on that. That's, you know, generally something that's considered under the purview of the dental board there, which is made up of dentists, hygienists, and a layperson there to kind of set what's a reasonable fee and the standards there. My personal expectation, I don't begin to imagine I'm speaking for the board on this, would be a fee comparable to what the local anesthetic fee is for hygienists, around $50.
Bob?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Logan, for that. And, you know, I really appreciate the fact that the Dental Society or whatever Association of Alaska wants to try and support the ability for assistants and hygienists to go out and do more procedures because we need it. You know, I was in McGrath a couple of years ago, and when a poor dentist, you know, in the fact that they're just bombarded, they could be there 18 hours a day for 3 days straight and not cover everybody. And when these clinics where they have to set up temporary chairs and facilities like that and then go to the next village just to try and provide just basic care, mm-hmm. that's just not available. And the ability to try and expand this, you know, I really think Representative Ramirez is doing a good job and working on that end, and I appreciate that effort because we need it. If somebody has went out there and talked to these people around the state and what they actually have to go through and the ability to try and have some of those assistants or hygienists in those communities to do some of these basic procedures. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I've heard this bill in Hess. I think it's a great bill. Okay. I don't have any other questions about it. I'm ready to move it out.
I don't believe this is the first time we've seen this. You know, I think it's been up several other years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this is the cleanest version that I can recall that we've had in front of us. And, any further questions for the doctor? Well, you got off light. Should have been here a half hour ago.
I'll take light. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Does the hygienist have to be from Alaska?
Yeah.
have a license.
We've got three people on line. I think we'll work through them, and we'll call you back up if we need you, but you're off the hook right now. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Jim Towell, are you with us?
Mr. Chairman, I have no real testimony. I simply asked to listen in and answer questions if it was appropriate.
And you can probably see which way the wind's blowing. Well, you can't because you're not here.
It's blowing from the west.
Well, thanks again for being online. How about David Eichler? Are you with us, David?
Hello.
Thank you for calling in. Care to testify?
Yes. My name's Dave Eichler. I'm a dentist in North Pole and president of the Board of Dental Examiners. And the board did consider the concept of this bill and overwhelmingly approved it, unanimously, of course. And no real comments. I agree with the representative who previously stated she'd just like to see it moved out. I could add a little bit about the fees. The fee structure for our licensees under the board are set by the department, they are to generally cover the cost of administration, so that'll be a little more information for that. And other than that, let's let her go.
Well, thank you for participating with us. Peter Higgins, are you questions only, or do you care to add something?
I'm the current president of the Alaska Dental Society, and pretty much I'm glad that you guys are ready to move this bill through, and so I really have nothing more to say other than thank you.
Well, thank you. Melody Whitlack.
Yes, hi. I'm glad to see this is going through as well. It made my job much easier. I used to be a dental assistant with expanded functions years ago, and now currently a registered dental hygienist in Juneau, Alaska. So this pleases me that this bill has gone forward this quickly. So I'm looking forward to it. That'd be great for the rest of the dental profession.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anybody else online that would care to testify on this bill? Is there anybody else in the room? With that, we'll close public testimony and bring it back to the table.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move committee substitute for House Bill Number 319, Version V, from committee with individual recommendations and attached.
Version L, I believe.
V.
V as in Victor.
V.
That's the one I'm moving.
Okay.
With attached individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no opposition, it will move out of committee. And with that, we will adjourn at 4:06.